Radio Free Press, a podcast from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, campaigning for free, independent and accountable media.
For much of the British media, especially television and radio, the desire to present balanced news coverage and context has always been an overriding objective. But the notion of achieving balance in news reporting has been tested to the limit during the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. The death and destruction, and especially the death of so many children, seems so much out of balance with the relatively minor impact of the Hamas rocket attacks on Israel. Equality in news reporting is just one of the issues troubling traditional media as a result of the recent turmoil in the Middle East. More journalists than ever before are losing their lives, and insurgents are increasingly using social media in their attempt to recruit and to spread propaganda. To discuss these troubling developments are a Stop the War activist, a correspondent who spent many years reporting from the front line in the Middle East, and a campaigner for ethical journalism. First, what do they think of the way the Gaza conflict has been reported, both here and internationally? Lindsay German, convener of the Stop the War Coalition, what's your verdict?
I think that the coverage has been very, very shocking in terms of the lack of balance. And certainly from my experience, I've been campaigning for many, many years. And we always tend to think that there is a bias against campaigns and against the Palestinians, which has always been the case. But I think this time much, much worse. The Israeli spokespeople have been given a great deal of time on broadcast media to put their views. This hasn't really been balanced at all. And I think the whole context is completely missing. So you get this idea that Israel's only defending itself, which does ignore what happened before last week or last month. And you get the idea that is it proportionate? Whereas, and this whole question is taken very, very seriously when anybody looking at the figures would regard it as disproportionate. So all of these things I think are very concerning for all of us.
Tim Llewellyn, as a former BBC correspondent, you had many years frontline experience in the Middle East. You're a writer and commentator now on the region. How do you rate the media's role and performance in this current conflict?
Well, across the whole media, I think the impact of what's happening in Gaza has come across. It's inevitable, the sheer weight of the pictures we've seen and the words we read across the whole media, whether it's official media or social media, has been enormous, and people cannot ignore what's happening there. And I think it is having an impact on the politics of the region. However, I totally agree with what Lindsay says, particularly about the BBC. You talked in your introduction about balance. I prefer to use the word impartiality. The BBC's reporting of the Israel-Palestine issue for the past 14 years now has been anything but impartial. The story is manipulated not by the reporters, but by the people who run news at the BBC in favor of Israel. I'll make two brief points here. One is lack of corrective context. Why are Gazans firing rockets at Israel? What happens in Gaza when we don't have these dramatic stages of war, which we've had three times now in the last 10 years? And also there's the question of causality. Israel is always presented as reacting to Palestinian violence, whereas Israel actually commits violence against the Palestinians, all of them, whether it's West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, or the Palestinians inside Israel, all the time. It goes on and on. If the BBC doesn't report this properly, then when the big action breaks out, people don't understand why. And it's the BBC's job, and I use the BBC because it's so important that this central news gathering and news delivering organization gets it right, because it has a worldwide responsibility. If the BBC cannot tell the story properly, then there's very little hope for impartial journalism, I think. And this story is being distorted by the BBC bosses.
Aidan White, as a former General Secretary of the International Federation of Journalists and now Director of the Ethical Journalism Network, you've been immersed in these dilemmas for years. Do you share the concern that we've just been hearing about? I mean, I think the Arab-Israeli conflict has been a source of distortion and bias for more than 50 years. We've actually, it's always been a major challenge for media people on the ground and abroad. So I absolutely agree that there is a problem of bias. And actually, I don't think there's a news desk in the Western world that doesn't sort of shake its head when, you know, unfortunately we have a breakout of the conflict, such as we've seen in the recent days. Actually, I think, oddly enough, of course there is bias in the way that the conflict has been covered, but I think we have seen more balanced journalism in reporting this particular attack on Gaza than we've seen, for example, in recent times. For example, compare this with what happened during Operation Cast Lead. At that time, the Israelis themselves sought to control the right of journalists to go into Gaza, to actually report from the spot. They tried to close the story down. This time, there were hundreds of media people, freelancers and journalists on the ground in Gaza getting the story out. As a result of that, it was impossible for it to be managed by the spin doctors of both Hamas and of Israel. And as a result of that, I think, we saw an inevitable sort of media concentration on a lack of proportion in the attacks that Israel has made. So therefore, the very high civilian casualties, the lack of clarity in what they were seeking to do. I do agree with Tim about the point about the need for context, about causality, about looking back at how this dispute began and so on. And of course, that's one of the ethical absolute imperatives of journalism, is that you tell the story in its fullest context. And this has not been done. I mean, for example, the relationship between the fact that the two split Palestinian groups, Hamas and Fatah, actually patched up their differences, creating a single unified Palestinian political movement for the first time in many years, has just been sort of put to one side. And this happened only weeks before this conflict broke out. And so clearly, by the targeting of Hamas, it's clear there's a political objective as well as a response to the murder of youngsters, which actually is traced back as being the trigger of this event. But unless journalists really look into the depths of the story, provide proper context, give people background that is absolutely essential for them to understand what's going on, then it's just going to be sensationalist news coverage. And that's very dangerous. And that's why there are serious ethical questions. What's the role of journalists here? It's not just to sort of put out the pictures and talk to the people who are involved in specific incidents. It's to explain it. It's to sort of put it in a proper context. And bearing in mind, as I said at the outset, this is a dispute that's been going on for 50 years. Journalists have to step back and do what they should be doing well. Good analysis, good background, and good context. But that's not been done.
Lindsay German, you've just heard some soul-searching by two journalists on this very issue of context. What then would you like the broadcasters to be doing more of? How can you actually get that context that you would like to see?
Well, I think it's firstly a question of people having the local knowledge, which a number of correspondents do, who are very experienced and who... my quarrel isn't particularly with the journalists who are in Gaza or in the West Bank, because there may be good or bad journalists, there may be people who are better or worse at getting this argument across. But I guess that most of them do try to have some integrity, do try to look at what is actually going on, and do have some idea of the background to it. The problem, it seems to me, is elsewhere. And I think that particularly at institutions like the BBC, and I have to say The Guardian as well, there's clearly an editorial decision to not always look at that context or to bring in other elements which aren't necessarily just looking at the context. So I think the editorial questions are very, very real questions. And we had this in 2009, for example, when the BBC refused to broadcast the disaster's emergency appeal. Now, this time, they said that they were going to, which I think we all welcome, but this was after they claimed nobody disputed it was a humanitarian disaster. In other words, after they got permission from the Israelis to be able to do it. So I think there are big questions there. So it's partly a question of who controls it editorially. It's also partly, I think, the way in which some media operates, and this again isn't necessarily the fault of the journalists, that the whole soundbite culture, the whole sort of immediacy, which you want to get, particularly in broadcast media, is something which very often denies the look at the context. And certainly I've been on a lot of media myself and been interviewed, and very often people say to you, yes, but this is history, this is, you know, you're talking about things that happened in the past, what about now, whatever the most immediate thing is, a rocket that's been fired or so on. And I think these are much bigger questions than what than just what the actual journalists as individuals do.
Now, we've heard from Tim and from Aidan the way in which Israel, in particular, tries to manage the media, and how, in Aidan's view, they've been failing because of events. Now, I was never a foreign correspondent myself, but I can reflect on these problems of trying to get balance and get context. I mean, for example, the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom is currently reflecting on the miners' strike of 30 years ago. Now, there you see, the criticism then was an imbalance in the BBC's coverage. The BBC was accused of being the cheerleader for Mrs. Thatcher, encouraging a return to work, and journalists like myself were in the dock for not doing enough to report what was happening, for example, in the mining villages and the complaints about brutality. But of course, part of the problem was that it was the government machine and the National Coal Board which controlled the flow of information and the statistics. Now, Tim, that's one of the points, isn't it, that the Israeli government, you must have had experience of this time and time again, how they, of course, will come down on journalists like a ton of bricks if they believe we're not reporting the context and the statistics that help them.
Well, this is a new thing, actually. When I was working in the Middle East, we ignored the Israelis. If they wanted to tell us we were telling lies, we just went on telling what we considered and thought and knew most of the time to be the truth. It was a very different context in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s. Things have changed in the last 14 years, and we may come to that. But I think the point here is, and I blame the BBC managers more than the reporters on this, is that if you are aware of the fact that one side has access to information and to the airwaves in a massive way with massive backing, as the Israelis do, both on the ground there and here with institutions like British Israel Communications and the Israeli embassy being so articulate, I think it's up to the broadcaster to make absolutely sure that the other voice, holding the ring, as it were, that the other voice, which is weaker, feebler, at a distance, not official, not state-backed, that the other voice is heard. And that voice exists, especially in London. There are hundreds of articulate Palestinians here who do not speak necessarily for organizations, but can explain the context of what's happening in Gaza, the dreadful condition, the strangulation of a people, which has been going on now since 1967. They can explain what's happening on the West Bank, but these people are not calling them. We've tried time and time again, giving lists to producers of articulate Palestinians, academics, journalists, editors, all kinds of people, and including some official Palestinians. But they are completely outnumbered by the presence of Israelis in the studio. I mean, sometimes you'd think the Israeli ambassador lived in New Broadcasting House. And this has been true in the last three massive Gaza cases of 2008-09, 2012, and the present one. So it's a failure of the BBC to understand its role, which is to create an impartiality. And I've had arguments with BBC bosses about that. They say this, they see this as taking sides. They're saying if one side's voice is weaker than the other, then that's their problem, not ours. But I believe in a conflict like this, which, as Aidan says, is now, well, it's 50, you could call it 100 years old. It's vital for the BBC to play its role properly, to instruct the public impartially, and to make sure that voice is heard. And not only does it not do that, it does not do that deliberately, in my view.
I agree with Tim about sort of the role of the BBC is extremely important. Although I have to say, it's not just the BBC that's reporting this from the UK. I mean, I think if you look at Channel 4 coverage, you'll find actually Channel 4 coverage has been quite distinct and different from that of the BBC. And to a certain extent, I mean, I understand why the BBC is under tremendous pressure. The Israeli government and its armed forces have identified strategically the value of information in this conflict, and they have invested heavily in ensuring that their ambassadors, their people, are absolutely ready to engage the moment that they've got something to say. And actually, it's an incredible investment. It's very important to understand this, that Israel sees the importance of controlling information as important as the ground as it works on the ground. But But I think it's also true, and here's a word of defence for the BBC. The BBC over the years has had crisis after crisis in which it has confronted governments who have accused the BBC of showing bias. Of course, the BBC was a bias in part over the miners' strike. Of course, we see it, and there are examples of bias here. But remember, for example, the Falklands War. Remember, for example, the role of the BBC in reporting Northern Ireland. The conflicts that the BBC got into because it sought to defend ethical principles of impartiality and independence and so on. It may well be that the balance on this particular story is not right, and that may be because of the context in which the BBC is trying to report it. But I think we have to get back to the reality that right across all of journalism is a failure to provide, it seems to me, the proper context. This is not just a conflict about today's casualty list, the numbers, the response of the international community to the tragedy as it's unfolding. It's about a long-term dispute that has its roots in rivalries and political aspirations that go back to the formation of Israel and go back to the conclusion of the 67 war, in which there was launched the campaign for Palestinian identity, Palestinian statehood, and the rights of Palestinians. And that remains unsolved. And I think that the failure of media to properly inform its viewers and readers and listeners about this context, I think, leads people to sort of shake their head with a lack of understanding about what's going on. Why, for example, would Hamas seek to visit upon its population, already vulnerable and marginalised, more attacks from one of the most powerful military forces in the world by lobbing a few sort of rockets which are completely useless and land in the ground? Why do they do that? It seems to be absolutely beyond any sort of sense. But they do that because they're seeking to highlight the central part of their argument, which is the continuing siege of Gaza, the creation of effectively a large concentration camp in which the people inside have no freedom of movement outside their borders by land or sea, and the fact that this is being maintained by Israel in defiance of all sort of principles of humanity, never mind international law and so on. So I think this question has to be brought forward so that people can understand that what people in Gaza are fighting for is not to inflict pain, destruction and death upon an Israeli community. They're actually fighting for their own survival. That message has just not emerged at all, and I think it's because of the lack of context in the way media report.
Could I just add very briefly to what Aidan said? I totally agree. I have not heard or read anywhere in the media, except in specialist media, the fact that after the 2012 violence in Gaza, there was a ceasefire agreement which the Israelis signed through parties with Hamas, in which the siege would be relieved, not stopped, but there would be allowed movement of goods and traffic through the Eretz crossing and other crossings from Israel into Gaza. That was part. It was a very important part of the agreement, and it was why Hamas signed up to it. It's what they'd been fighting for. For the next year, about three rockets were fired into Israel, and not by Hamas, by other dissident groups. Israel never took part in that agreement. It never acknowledged that agreement. It never did anything about it. And that went on and on. And in the end, Hamas, frustrated by many other things, the agreements with the PA, with Fatah, saw no other way to attract attention. But the point is, we don't hear that side of the story, which is terribly important. It's why this has happened. All we hear about is the exchange of artillery.
The other thing we don't, and it follows on from this point, there's never any suggestion about what could begin to solve some of these problems. So it's always Hamas has got to give up its arms, but they never talk about what the peace agreements are. They never talk about the demands of the present talks in Cairo, which are for the airport and the port and all the other things that people want to happen. So it's always put as if these evil people have to stop firing rockets and then Israel won't respond anymore and then it will all be okay. And that totally misses out that they only are interested in covering it when people are being killed. They're not interested in covering it when And Palestinians themselves have many different views on what the solutions are and so on. But it does seem to me this is, you never get this. You never even get a documentary programme which says this is what these people would want. This is the differences between the different groups in Palestine. This is what different people in Israel are saying. You never hear this kind of thing. So it becomes this sort of natural disaster that, and then you get the usual thing. They've hated each other for hundreds or thousands of years, as sometimes said, you know, rather exaggeration, which means you can never look at actually what is happening, because they didn't hate each other for hundreds of years. It isn't true.
Let's now change direction and look at the impact of social media, because there's no doubt about it that the traditional media are being challenged as never before by what is appearing online. Let's quickly start with you, Lindsay German. What do the peace campaigners and Stop the War think about the way in which the insurgents can use social media as a recruiting sergeant, for example, as a way of putting over propaganda which many people might find offensive? How does that square with the campaigns that you mount?
Well, I think that people, all different sorts of people, will use social media for their own purposes. And obviously people who are insurgents will put forward their arguments. But I think what's much more important is that there's been a massive increase in the general level of knowledge about Palestine and about a range of other issues, that people now can read, they can see film, they can do all of this without having to go to the BBC or the mainstream broadcast media or the print media. They do it and they know much more. They know, I mean, you always know more now. Before, if you follow social media, you know about things that are happening in the Middle East before they're reported in the mainstream press. So I think it's very, very important. And it's very important for another reason, that it helps to mobilise people, that we have international demonstrations, we have days of action. And we always say, when we had 2 million people marching in 2003, the only people who've really got film of that, as far as I know, are the BBC, ITV, Sky, who all covered it. But you have to pay to get that coverage. Now, you'd have millions of people filming it, and perhaps not as well, but that does make a big difference to how people mobilise and how they see it.
Have the terms of trade really changed as dramatically as Lindsay is saying, Tim Llewellyn?
Oh, yes. I mean, I have a friend, a young friend, who's brilliant at this whole social media, at which I am not adept, I hasten to say. And I can see through watching what she puts on Facebook, that the way she disseminates statements, film, positions, lectures, debates like this, puts it out on her own networks. She gets reactions, she gets into arguments, she gets into debates with other people, but it's a massive spread of information which the official media would hardly get into. So there's a whole new range of information out there spreading across mostly much younger people who before may not have been informed or even interested, but are getting interested because they're made to be interested, because it's appearing suddenly on their sites. My only reservation about it all is that I do think there's always still a role for what you might call the official media. I think news does have to be mediated, because as well as these interesting arguments and statements and debates that go on places like Facebook, there's a lot of rubbish out there. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of disinformation. And believe me, the dark forces that do exist will not be slow, and have not been slow, in getting in on these areas as well.
Now, let's turn to Aidan White. You, of course, have represented journalists internationally. Sure. For a quarter of a decade. You must have seen this change taking place, where suddenly social media is often driving the agenda.
Well, I mean, I think it is. Clearly, you know, we're living in a world where it's not the media and traditional journalists who are the gatekeepers of information now. We have a situation where the audience is in the newsroom. The audience is actually helping to provide the news and also to disseminate the news. This is great. It's good for free expression. It's liberating. But actually, as Tim says, there is a dark side. Look, we're having this conversation 2 days after we saw on the internet the execution of a journalist in Iraq. It was the most brutal and fearful and outrageous action that you could hope to see. It was harrowing in the worst sense. And this seems to me to show the darkest side, the most painful side of the open information society. Media savvy terrorists and media savvy interest groups now use social media and the internet as a key instrument in getting their message across and in carrying out their destructive processes. We've seen what's been happening in Gaza as a result of good social media. It's not been possible for this story to be massaged by spin doctors on any side. That's clear. But I absolutely agree with Tim. This is not something that you can leave to social media or people on the laptops and smartphones to be able to explain to one another. They can exchange information which is often a reflection of a prejudice or is often a sort of reflection of a very special interest. It seems to me it's absolutely vital that there is a professional input to sort of mediate this information, to filter it, to actually extract from it what is relevant, what is useful, and what is responsible, to try to give people a sort of clarity in what's going on instead of leaving them in the mess and chaos of information that comes from all sides, Twitter, Facebook, blogs, and so on and so forth. And that's absolutely vital. So while I would say it's great to have the free expression of the internet and so on, it's not journalism, and it's not ethical of itself. So therefore, we have to therefore restore confidence in journalism as providing the capacity not to tell people what has happened. There's been a bombing, there's been an artillery attack, but actually to explain it and to give them background which will help them sort of better understand what's going on.
Now, a follow-up point to that, though, Aidan White, is that, of course, we are seeing journalists, and you've spoken about the death of a journalist in Iraq, the beheading of a journalist. We're seeing an increasing number of journalists now being targeted by both sides.
Absolutely.
And therefore, increasingly, it is the online actuality, what might have been captured on someone's mobile phone, for example, that's actually often appearing on mainstream media. So that's what I mean about how suddenly we can get the actuality straight from the scene in the way that we've never been able to before.
Look, that's absolutely right. But what we have is we've also got to understand the context in which we're receiving that information. The point about it is almost instantaneous. And one of the things about the contemporary media environment is the competitive nature of it. There is a rush to publish information as quickly as possible. And when there's a rush to publish, you don't have time to verify, is this image correct? Is this adopted image and so on and so forth. We have numerous examples of traditional media being taken in by groups that have massaged information and doctored images and said this is what's going on. And the rush to publish has encouraged people to publish it without verification, without fact-checking and so on. So therefore, yes, it's true. We have immediacy, but immediacy is the enemy of ethics. Because actually, if you're going to have ethical journalism, it's got to be thinking journalism, and you've got to have time to think. You've got to have time to verify, to check facts, and so on. So I'm in favour in this sort of situation of slower journalism, of taking your time, of saying, look, something's got to be checked out. We need to we need to take 30 seconds before we press the send button on our computers and so on to get in order to make sure information is clear. That's a real challenge in an age where everybody wants to get it as quickly as possible. That when we're talking about the importance of seconds in getting the information out, this is, it seems to me, one of the greatest challenges to modern journalism.
Now, Aidan White has talked about the death of journalists. Tim Llewellyn, one of the developments which fascinates many people is that the journalists, and Aidan has talked about the number, and you've talked about the number, who are now at work in Gaza. They, of course, are working under constraints, aren't they? They're not allowed, they're not able, for example, to film the actual launch sites of rockets. They're not allowed to film the Hamas military personnel. What do you think of that ethical dilemma that journalists are facing now? That they can't provide the whole of the context that Lindsay is talking about?
In this case, they wouldn't have been allowed to, for instance, to film British soldiers operating in Northern Ireland either. I don't see that this... I think this is what happens in military areas. Journalists have access to some things. The military don't allow them access to others, whether they're Israelis, Hamas, or the British Army. I'd just like to add one thing to what Aidan said before we get onto this. I wonder whether this poor American would have been executed by ISIS if they hadn't known that that picture, that film, would have gone right round the world. Because if they'd done it and sent it to official media, as it were, those pictures wouldn't have been used. Now, they know that that's a recruiting poster. It'll alienate millions of people, but it'll attract and interest hundreds of thousands of potential jihadists, and they know that. And they're getting tremendous publicity out of it. So it's an area where social media has a disadvantage, and we can't... social media is a great source for us in places like the BBC. It's another source, like Monitoring or AFP or Reuters. But, of course, now, because of the non-official way that the media works, everybody can see it. We have no way of mediating it. As to the position of journalists, and I think this is the one thing that's changed most since I was working in, you know, war areas, low-intensity conflict areas, revolutionary areas like Lebanon and Palestine, Iraq, which proper war, is that we journalists have become a target now. That's what's changed. We used to get injured and shot and killed occasionally because we were in the way, we were in the wrong place at the wrong time, because we were in a war zone. It happens. But the big change, I think, over the last 15 to 20 years has been, first of all, the kidnapping of journalists in the 1980s. That was the beginning of it. But now the ransoming, the killing of journalists, we are now in the front line. And also, we're wearing helmets, we're wearing flak jackets, we look like part of the army. Now, there are good reasons why we do, but we never did when I was doing it. Now, maybe that was a bad thing, maybe we should have, but it changes the image of the journalist. I mean, this poor chap who was killed, the pictures of him, he's wearing a helmet, a flak jacket. I mean, he looks like a soldier. So you can see how the jihadists, in some ways, would identify the journalist as being part of an invading army.
Now, Tim has spoken about how journalists are almost appearing as though they are embedded, because, of course, they're wearing flak jackets and helmets. Of course, this was the complaint 30 years ago in the miners' dispute. Mm. Journalists, radio and television weren't welcome in a lot of places, and therefore filmed from behind the police lines. Yes. And that, of course, led to these criticisms of imbalance. Lindsay German, in finally looking ahead, what would you think is the message that you would like to get out from the Stop the War campaign to the British news media?
Well, what I'd like to get out, first of all, is that there are many, many stories that are never covered and that could be covered, and that I do think, I mean, I slightly disagree with Aidan over this, I think that the social media is very, very important in bringing many of those stories out to light. And of course there are conspiracy theories, and of course there are forgeries, but that's always been true, and people will always use the most modern media in order to get across their message, and this is true even of terrorists and so on. And actually, one of the things that I think people don't understand about the groups, even like ISIS, is how much they are in touch with modern communication methods. And, you know, they're treated as though, and quite rightly in many ways, as though they're acting very barbarically. But actually, they do understand this. So I think it's very important that we do get these messages across in that way. I also do believe that there is a place for informed and serious journalism. And I think the problem we have is there is too little of that, not because journalists don't want to do it, but because of the constraints of the publishers, of the editors, and of all of these people. And it has led to a deterioration of journalism. If you think, with just one very small example, which is a bit away from this, but the way that local newspapers now, people will take your news release and, you know, transfer it onto the page without altering it at all, because there is one person doing, making up the whole newspaper or doing all the news stories. So all of that, I think, are very, very serious questions for us. But I think what's also important is that those of us who protest and who campaign around these things, it has to be a constant thing that we take the media into account. And it's not an accident, really, that the last four or five demonstrations I've been on, from the teachers, from the People's Assembly, and from the Gaza protests, many of them have started at the BBC, because many people, whatever, and people have made the point that the BBC isn't all bad, and I agree with that, but people do see it as a broadcasting corporation which is very much on the side of the or against the underdog. That's really how it's seen, against the protesters and against the people in Gaza.
Thank you. Tim Llewellyn, you've heard Lindsay make that point about the BBC. You have reflected on that yourself. Mm. Looking ahead now, how do you think the traditional media are going to be able to cope with this? Do you see standards? We'll ask Aidan in a moment about the ethics of this, but do you see the ability of the traditional news media to deliver the balance and context becoming much harder and harder as time goes on?
Well, obviously, some of the official, as I call it, media, like Channel 4 News, have been brilliant in covering this conflict in Gaza, and they've been quite emotional about it, and I think they've reflected on the ground that journalists can become concerned about what's going on. And I think occasionally, I don't recommend it as a habit, but I think occasionally to reflect that emotion, as John Snow did the other day, I think it brings across to the viewer that if they're getting upset, then so should I be. But the images, of course, are the most important thing. The other day, a former BBC head of news and current affairs called Mark Damaser, a very clever man, said that the BBC's job was to hold the ring in the national debate. Now, that is a very fine ambition, and I think that's part of what the BBC does and should do. And it implies that you give everybody's point of view equal space. And we know, Nick and I, through election times, the stopwatch mechanisms which are used to make sure that the Liberals got, you know, a quarter of the time and the other two got, you know, it was all terribly silly, really. But I think that what I would say to Mark Damaser is this: it's all very well to hold the ring, but when it comes to news reporting, it's not enough just to give both sides. And to what I think the BBC does, I'm afraid, in the Palestine-Israel dispute, is to give what I've used this phrase, spurious equivalents. It isn't two equal sides. It isn't a disputed matter. It's a question of one side aggressing another, occupying their land, continuing to steal it at gunpoint, and besieging people and making their lives a continuous misery. The BBC, which I admire in so many ways, and I wish it would get back to some of its old ways that Aidan was talking about, has to reflect this. And if it doesn't, it's not telling the people who pay for it and to whom it owes a duty, it's not telling them the truth. And I hope that the impact of all these protests and all these pictures they've seen and the other channels doing it better, and The Guardian, as Lindsay says, isn't sacrosanct. I mean, The Guardian does a bit of this balance as well, so-called balance. If some of this may start to stir the BBC bosses, but I have to say that as someone who's at the, you know, sharp end of this, I see no sign of them stirring yet.
Well, finally, we'll ask Aidan. You've heard of the concerns of Lindsay, of Tim. Putting your hat on as director of the of this Foundation for Ethical Journalism, do you think that the journalists are up for the challenge, that we're going to be actually going to be able to meet some of the objectives that we've just heard about?
Well, I mean, I think they are. I mean, when I talk to journalists, they complain bitterly about not being able to do their jobs for various reasons. It may be because of official constraints. It may be because of internal constraints in the newsrooms from which they're working from. Do journalists want to tell the story as best they can? Yes, of course they do, and they've got good stories to tell. The problem about it is they're living in an environment which is extremely difficult for them. I mean, Tim loves the BBC. You can tell how passionately he loves the BBC and the idea of the BBC by his criticism of it. And he's right to absolutely sort of demand that it moves towards realising its aspirations and so on. And I think all journalism, you know, people in journalism want to do the same thing. They want to deliver stories that are good, are ethical, useful, reliable, and are on time. The problem is, if we live in a world where everything is open now, the problem is that our industry, the traditional industry, is in decline. It's not investing as much in journalism as it used to. We have to find new ways to finance journalism and so on. We can complain about the way that journalists are working, but very often journalists are working in terrible social conditions. They're badly paid. They don't have enough protection. They are expected to do a story and risk their lives, you know, in order to deliver the information that's necessary. So the answer to your question is yes, journalists are ready to do it. Yes, there are people who are committed to the notion of the ethical notion of, you know, of truth, accuracy, independence, impartiality, and so on. The problem about it is they're not given enough support, and we have to work out ways in which they can be given more support. That means we have to put pressure on groups like the BBC to try to make sure that their journalists are supported, and on the whole they do it. We have to put pressure on every, and above all, we have to say to governments and military people, take your hands off the controls. Allow journalists to work freely.
On that point, we'll bring the discussion to a close. My thanks to Lindsay German of the Stop the War Coalition, Tim Llewellyn, a former BBC correspondent, and to Aidan White of the Ethical Journalism Network. This podcast was recorded and produced by Claire Colley for the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom.